However much the breakthrough advanced our understanding of the human psyche, it was not enough to keep me from souring on essential aspects of Freudian theory and practice. I discovered that in both its therapeutic work and its discourse, psychoanalysis relied on a vocabulary that was problematic. The term neurosis, for example, could refer to so many different conditions and was so unclear that it is no longer used for scientific purposes. Moreover, the psychiatrist and writer Thomas Szasz has shown that the elite members of Freud's inner circle used the vocabulary of analysis to dismiss those in the circle who disagreed with Freud. One member wrote of an apostate who developed psychotic manifestations that reveal themselves in a turning away from Freud and his doctrines. When terminology can be used as a weapon, the enterprise from which it is drawn deserves to be suspect. I lost faith in Freudian theory for another reason. Freud was stuck in the mores of his times, certain that what was true for turn-of-the-century Vienna was true for all times. This led him to conclusions that don't make any sense today. So in Civilization and Its Discontents, probably his most widely read book, he writes, "My intention is to represent the sense of guilt as the most important problem in the development of civilization, and to show that the price we pay for our advance in civilization is a loss of happiness through the heightening of the sense of guilt." This is wrong. Who experiences guilt today? How many public figures can you think of who offered a sincere mea culpa after wrongdoing? We live in a country in which guilt has become less common than it once was. Freud generalized from his experience in Vienna and England, but mores can change, and so can morality. Freud's patients may have been racked by guilt, but I doubt that the many patients who visit psychotherapists today are expressing similar feelings. Discovering holes in my hero's theories came as a terrible blow. It felt like a betrayal and the end of romance. Perhaps what my experience teaches is simply this: a book can change your life, but it may not change it forever. In the same course in which I read Freud for the first time, I was exposed to another book that moved me toward my chosen career. Suicide, written by an eminent French sociologist named Émile Durkheim in 1897, is a foundational work in sociology. It begins with a core idea. Even though suicide is the penultimately individual act, it cannot be explained by individual characteristics. Durkheim examines mental illness, alcoholism, and race, but finds that these characteristics will not help him make sense of the data. To put it another way, if we think of the sum of individual suicides as forming a coherent rate of suicide in a given place or a given group, we will need to look at collective life if we are to explain it. One of Durkheim's most persuasive arguments comes in his discussion of marriage and suicide. Marriage, the death tables reveal, insulates people from suicide. But is this because marriage as an institution has this effect, or is it because those who get married are better equipped psychologically and physically to avoid suicide whether or not they marry? In other words, are those who marry self-selected to resist suicide and not the beneficiaries of marriage as an institution? It turns out that the data reveal an institutional effect. This has some real relevance today. The difference between an institutional effect and the effect of self-selection is a little like the difference between institutional racism and individual racism. Durkheim made a strong case for social causes that work independently of individual causes. Durkheim goes on to show the effect of religious groups also. Jews commit fewer suicides than Catholics and Protestants. Why is this? Because Jews, historically both small in number and social outcasts, bind together in solidarity, and this solidarity or integration is a prophylactic against suicide. Similarly, Catholics have a lower suicide rate than Protestants because the Catholic Church, with its hierarchy and its traditions, bind members together in a way not nearly so common among Protestants. Ever since the Reformation, Protestants have chosen Bibles in translation, not in Latin, have attended a diverse number of churches, and have been free to think for themselves about spiritual matters. It is the cohesion of an institution that helps prevent members from suicide, and the Catholic Church is more cohesive than Protestant churches. Durkheim offers many other insights in his book, some having to do with politics, some with suicides that have their cause in aberrant forms of collective life. But he maintains throughout that we must look for the key to suicide, not in individual proclivities, but in communal organization. Were it not for this kind of thinking, the study of human behavior would be reduced to the study of individual choice. A few academics, by the way, would like this and prefer this, that individual choice explains all of human behavior. But to me, it would have not been pleasant to study this for the 8 or 9 years that I would have to. And when people were hearing that I was going to study sociology, they often asked me, well, what is sociology? And after telling them, I tried something like this. Suppose you were interested in understanding crime in a given area. You could begin your inquiry by focus on the kind of people who commit the crime. That's a psychological approach. Or you could focus on the community in which the crime occurs and consider its conditions. That's how sociology would proceed. This was a satisfactory explanation for everyone, including me. Let me make a few final remarks about life-changing books before moving on to art. First, because a book can change a life, it does not mean that it will change it for the better. Hitler's biography, Mein Kampf, written in the 1920s, probably recruited some readers for National Socialism and the tragedy that followed. Similarly, the fraudulent book, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, published 2 decades earlier, spoke of a global takeover of the world by Jews, a lie nevertheless believed by some. Books can corrupt their readers as well as edify them. Second, I have not mentioned a work of fiction so far. I do not want for even one moment to suggest that novels cannot change the lives of their readers. If any of you saw The Great American Read on public television, you heard the testimony of readers of novels. The show is only about novels. Novels may even have more impact than nonfiction because they develop characters we identify with and plots that engage us. Until recently, nonfiction has not drawn on these elements. With your permission, I will leave the world of social science and turn to the world of art. It was in an art class in my sophomore year at Columbia that I felt my life change again. Sitting in a room with the lights out and slides projected on the screen, I learned to appreciate what was before me, but had not yet learned how to see. The class was Art Humanities. Unlike so many courses in art history, it did not attempt to survey all of Western art. Though never explicitly stated, I understood the course's purpose was to teach students how to approach a work of art, what to look for in architecture, painting, or sculpture. Its method was to focus in detail on 12 artists or works of art. We began with the Parthenon, which we studied for at least 4 weeks. We looked at every aspect of the great Greek temple, its columns, its capitals, the curved space between the columns, the pediments, the statuary decorating the pediments. We learned a new vocabulary, words like metope and triglyph, to help us appreciate the Parthenon's friezes. We learned the overall dimensions and plan of the building and how it was related to its religious function. Frankly, I didn't know there was so much to learn about a building. We next moved on to study the cathedral at Amiens, a great Gothic structure. There seemed to be at least as much information to discuss here. Flying buttresses on the exterior, vaulting inside, a huge interior space that made a visitor feel tiny and made medieval worshippers sense the vastness of God's heavenly realm. If I had any doubt that the slides and prints were having a profound effect on me, it was removed one day in Riverside Park. I was there for tennis, my physical education class that semester. I looked up to see Riverside Church, a splendid Gothic structure, whose form narrowed as it reached toward the sky. And then turned my head and I saw a modern box-like building standing one block south of the church. What different approaches to space, I said to myself. I had seen both buildings dozens of times, but this was the first time they constituted more than a part of the background. When you are taught to see, the familiar becomes noteworthy. Nor was my experience in the park the only experience that felt like an epiphany. During the class, we were encouraged to go to art museums and to look at some of the artists we were studying. El Greco was one of the 12 artists, and one day I was walking through the Metropolitan Museum, and I came upon El Greco's The Opening of the Fifth Seal, a late work by the Spanish master. The painting is dominated by a large rendering of Saint John adorned in a loose blue robe, his eyes turned toward heaven in supplication, his arms outstretched above his head. Unlike the other small figures on the canvas, he is quite close to the surface of the painting. As I looked at the work the first time I had seen it, I felt a pulse go through me as though I had been tasered. Perhaps it was the ecstatic quality of the painting that ignited the feeling in me, but I had never had the experience before and would never have it again. The art humanities course proved so interesting, I took three more art classes at Columbia before I left. Not a common occurrence for someone studying sociology. Whether a book or a painting changes one's life does not depend on the book or work alone. A work must come before an individual receptive to its change, to its message. Whether this is the case often depends on the age of the reader, could be the gender. But when literature and art meet someone ready to experience it, it reminds us that art enables us to find ourselves and lose ourselves at the same time. Thank you. We're now going to have